Broadcasting from the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I am your host, Darren Cambridge, and just yesterday, the Global Campus launched the online course Demystifying Monitoring and Evaluation for Practitioners, which covers a range of issues critical to establishing a culture and practice of effective monitoring and evaluation for peacebuilding programs. Monitoring and evaluation, or M&E, as it's oftentimes referred to, has become increasingly important, particularly for peacebuilding organizations and practitioners. As conflicts become more complex, funds become less available, and as the dynamics on the ground in conflict-affected communities can shift dramatically at any moment. How do we as peacebuilders know with confidence that our work is actually making a difference or having an impact? Reflecting on this question, I'm reminded of a quote from peace educator and the vice president of the academy here at USIP, George Lopez. And this comes from his online course, Strategic Peacebuilding. He said, "If war is too important, as we sometimes say, to be left to the generals, then peace is too important to be left just to those of us with good heart, good intention, and a couple of textbooks on peacebuilding. What we need to do is to approach our situations in a way in which we recognize the challenges from start to finish. We begin to plan for those dynamics, deal with the various components of those challenges we will face, and find ways to continually evaluate those as we are going on, and not to run away from the complexity, but to embrace it under the umbrella of what we call strategic peacebuilding." End quote. In short, peacebuilding as a field has recognized that good intentions are not good enough. In fact, good intentions can actually create harm if the work is not properly monitored and evaluated. My co-host joining me today in the studio is Andy Blum, Vice President for Program Management and Evaluation here at the United States Institute of Peace. He is also the lead instructor in the Global Campus course, Demystifying Monitoring and Evaluation for Practitioners, which, as I said, just launched yesterday and will be running throughout the month of March. Andy, it's good to have you with us in the studio.
Good to be here.
And our guest today is Sandra Malone. Sandra is the Executive Vice President of Search for Common Ground, one of the world's leading international non-governmental organizations working in peacebuilding and conflict transformation. Sandra also founded the Women's Peace Center in Burundi. She is a founding member of the European Platform for Conflict Prevention and Transformation, of the European Peacebuilding Liaison Office, and of the Child Soldiers Initiative. She has served on the board of the International Federation of Associations in Belgium and as the vice chair of the board of directors of the Alliance for Peacebuilding. Sandra, thank you so much for being with us in the studio today.
Darren, thank you for inviting me.
We're also joined by our many listeners from around the world who we invite to engage with our guest and help guide the conversation. Our on-air producer, Althea Middleton-Detzner, will be moderating your questions and comments throughout the show. Althea, can you say hello to our listeners?
Hi, listeners. Thanks for joining us today.
So if you have a question or a comment, all you need to do is notify Althea by clicking the little raise hand button that you will see on your control panel. And Althea will get you queued up. She will let you know when you are about to go on air, and she'll unmute you and will bring you into the show so you can share your question or comment directly. If you do not have a microphone on your computer, you can also instant message Althea by typing your question or comment into the chat box in your control panel, and Althea will read it for you on air. So let's get started. Before we get into the specifics of your work, Sandra, we like to get to know a little bit about our guests beyond their profession. So we do an exercise called 3-2-1, which involves a series of questions that are intended to reveal a little bit about your personality, your motivations, your interests, etc. And actually, Andy and the other instructors in the course, Jeff Krentel and Osama Garizi, have also had to answer these questions. And all the participants in the course have been invited to respond to these questions. So now you must as well, since you are joining our community. So the first question is, what are three things that people might be surprised to learn about you?
That's scary. First one, I have to travel a lot for my work, which I love, except for the having to be on airplanes part. I'm petrified of flying, and I have to do it all the time. That's one big one. A second one, which I think is why I fell in love with Africa to begin with, was that my parents met many years ago in Niamey, in Niger, and that I went to high school after many years after that in Rwanda. And thirdly, probably what motivates me on a daily basis is feeling that the only thing that truly matters in life is being present for people when they are most in need.
Thank you. And what are two of your most favorite places that you've ever visited? I know this has got to be difficult because you've traveled all over the world.
Well, not only because I've traveled, what a privilege, but also because the world is just divine. There are so many places that are beautiful in so many different ways, but I've chosen two right in my head right now. One is in the northern part of Ivory Coast, in a place called Bouaké, which I was so privileged to be able to go to in the first delegation that crossed during the war from the south to the north. Very strong memories of that place. And secondly, completely different, also in a bit of a jungle, is on a very different coast from Ivory Coast to Costa Rica. And I just discovered last February the amazing jungle around Cahuita on the eastern coast. And I fell in love with it.
Wonderful. And then who is one person, past or present, dead or alive, who you'd like to sit down and have dinner with?
I've always wanted to meet Niccolo Machiavelli because I've always wanted to know what it is that might motivate people who commit acts of violence and impunity and other horrible things, what motivates them, and therefore what you might use in order to prevent them from committing further acts of violence. So Machiavelli, I think.
All right.
Sandra, before we jump into the monitoring and evaluation discussion, we did want to hear a bit about Search for Common Ground. You have a long history with Search for Common Ground. You set up their Brussels office in 1994 before you came here to DC. So just bring us up to date on the work of Search and your approach to conflict transformation.
Thank you. So Search for Common Ground, for those of you who don't know it, is one of the NGOs that works in peace building and conflict transformation. We're in about 35 different countries at this point, and we have been around for 33 years. And our mission is to transform the way in which the world deals with conflict, from adversarial, non-cooperative approaches towards cooperative solutions. And we accompany processes for groups to get to know each other, political groups, religious groups, ethnic groups. We work both with the political, religious community leadership and with community groups themselves, and a tremendous amount with media, with and through media, in order to create a culture of mediation.
You specifically use the word conflict transformation, and I think you talked a little bit about what that means for Search. You know, what do you count as one or a few of your biggest successes in conflict transformation?
Okay, that's a tough question. If I may, I would like to not pinpoint one or the other successes. I'd like to just reflect a little bit on our history as an organization and the role that we have had the joy of being able to play alongside USIP and so many of the other organizations which currently exist in actually building a field where there was none. And so in terms of really enabling non-traditional actors to have a say in how the conflicts around them get resolved and really building something lasting for society in its totality, I would say that the creating of a space and putting peace building on the map in the world is one of the things which SEARCH has done as an organization, of which we're very proud. Now, hopefully, our partners and the governments with which we work and the community groups with whom we work in the 35 countries where we work each have something, inshallah, positive to say about our little contribution to their resolution and transformation of conflict. But I think it's more about the totality of our work.
So a couple terms that you mentioned. First, you said non-traditional actors. Could you give us some examples of what you mean by a non-traditional actor and how's that different from a traditional actor?
Certainly. It has been the presumption of most governments throughout history that they are the ones who actually are both the causers, but more importantly, the resolvers of conflict. And that when something happens in a country, it's the government's responsibility to do that. And when something happens between two countries, it's those two governments' responsibilities for finding solutions. Well, as the world has evolved, as you know, non-governmental organizations and community groups have really taken a lead with governments in trying to resolve the issues that are sometimes actually impossible for those governmental traditional actors to resolve alone. So that's a little bit what I mean by non-traditional. And I add to that it isn't always people who are in official functions who manage to bring peace about and to make solutions blossom. So you have actors, you have singers, you have religious leaders, you have women's group, you have children. People don't ask children their opinion, and Lord knows they have a stake in the future of, well, both of today and of tomorrow. And in terms of some of the wording around conflict transformation, I think John Paul Lederach was probably one of the first people to refer to conflict transformation as opposed to conflict management or conflict resolution. And we find ourselves, like USIP, using that term most often because really what it's about is finding the constructive change initiatives and looking at the larger framework and puzzle, if you will, to really understand what are the many leverage and entree points you need to hit in order, peacefully hit, in order to find solutions. Nothing is ever about one static conflict. There's so many dimensions to a conflict that we look at the totality of it and refer to it as conflict transformation, which always has both an aspect of process and longevity. It's not one moment in time. It's much longer term.
So jumping into a conversation more directly on evaluation, I don't think it's just, I'm not saying this just to flatter you, but Search for Common Ground, I think, was an early mover in our field on monitoring and evaluation. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how SEARCH originally identified the need to improve monitoring and evaluation. You know, sort of what's the origin story, you might say, of the monitoring and evaluation and learning work at SEARCH?
First of all, thank you for what you said about our work. Nice to hear. You know, I think for many years, our sense, like many people in peace building, was that just bringing groups together, just creating fora through which people can communicate and get to understand each other and their motivations, their needs, their fears, and doing things differently than the status quo, bridging those divides, creating communications channels between groups, etc., in and of itself was enough. Like, that's already something transformational. And when you experience the difference it makes in individuals' lives to be brought together and to have those breakthroughs, those moments of connectedness, then you have that gut instinct in your heart, in your tripes, that, oh, you're making a difference. But as the field of peace building started to develop, as more and more actors started to flood in, which is a wonderful thing, so did the questions. How do you prove that you make a difference? How do you know that, you know, the programming that you're doing actually matters and has any kind of long-lasting effect? But it took us a long time to go from just anecdotal individual stories to really trying to think systemically and systematically about the impact that we're having, the difference that we're making. And part of it was internal pressure, meaning, you know, why do I get up every morning if I don't have proof that what I do makes a difference? And part of it was external. Part of it was external because, as you know, I think probably the British government, DFID, was probably the first about 15 years ago, starting to ask, you know, how do you prove it? You know, what are the indicators? What are the benchmarks? How do you monitor this? How do you evaluate this? And correlating an organization's capacity to prove that they're watching and they understand to their capacity to leverage interest and funding. So 11 years ago, in 2004, is when we made a really explicit effort to put in place teams and systems to start to analyze what we were really doing. Because at the end of the day, the only thing we want to do is make more of a positive difference in the world. So since then, I'll just cite a few of the things that we've done. I must say, very early on, we had a philosophy of action and of viewing our work. And that was whether the work is evaluated to be good or not good, the most important thing is to put it out there with all of its warts and imperfections to actually help the field to learn with us. So let me give you a couple examples of works that we've put together, which we hope are useful for the field. One is a manual that is called Designing for Results, and that was published in 2006, and we're in the process of seeing with you guys, actually, whether we can get to a second edition of that. And we have a series of internal documents that have to do with understanding what frameworks and what questions need to be asked to follow and monitor the work that we are doing. We have guidance on social science methodology to actually help measure the intangibles. In our field, we're always talking about the intangibles, things that are neither qualitative nor quantitative, but that make a difference. And so that's a piece of work which has come out very recently, which is called Measuring the Unmeasurable. And thirdly, I just want to point to an important paper we put together, which is called How Technology Can Be Integrated into Monitoring and Evaluation of Peacebuilding Programs.
you talked about a bit about this sort of desire to be transparent. And I wanted to follow up on that a bit. Search does make all of their evaluations public. I raise that in part because it's good for our students to know. They can go to Search for Common Ground's website and see some of this work. But I think there's a real debate in some organizations about making evaluations public, because you want to balance the need to be sort of brutally honest with yourself with the desire to be sort of open and transparent. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the debates I'm sure you've had within your organization on that issue.
Of course, we have had and we continue to have debates about this. We always have come out on the side that it's better to expose and to be challenged than it is to hide and be afraid of the knowledge that's out there. At the same time, the evaluation needs to be framed in a way that the information that comes out is also safe for all of the participants and groups who might be directly or indirectly affected by the work. So, you know, we do like, of course, to have conversations with evaluators, internal evaluators and external evaluators, about how you keep both the integrity and the honesty of the findings, and you protect the people whom it might affect negatively. And I don't mean Search for Common Ground. I really mean the communities, horrible word, but you know, sometimes they're called beneficiaries, right? Our partners, the people in the countries in which we work.
Now, in the first session of this course, Andy, you actually mentioned the problem and challenge with self-deception. You actually called yourself out. You said, you know, I've been a program manager and I know what it's like to tell yourself, yes, this program is working, if, you know, and ask me about it. I'm the one who knows the most about it. So the point you're trying to make is that managers of peacebuilding programs can deceive themselves when determining whether or not their programs have been effective. And you actually make this point by referencing a driver safety study. So I'm wondering, could you tell us more about that study? I think it's important to make your point.
Yeah, it's a simple idea. I mean, an insurance company basically asked people, are you a safe driver? Are your friends safe drivers? And something like, I don't remember the exact percentages, but something like 80% of us think we're safe drivers, but only 30% of us would say that our friends are safe drivers. So we tend to think we ourselves are good at what we do, but we don't necessarily see that when we're looking sort of outside of ourselves.
So Sandra, this is just kind of one of the many challenges that are going to be addressed in this course, this challenge of self-deception. And I'm wondering, what are some challenges that your organization, that Search was facing, that brought about this need to be more intentional about monitoring and evaluation and really be out there in the lead? And was this element of self-deception part of that decision? When you reflect back on prior to, you said 2004 is when you really made this concerted effort. When you reflect back on it, you know, can you recall moments where you're like, yeah, I think we were deceiving ourselves a little bit in terms of, yes, there are some great anecdotal stories, as you mentioned earlier, but at the end of the day, did it actually have an impact or the impact that we thought it had?
I think there was lots of self-deception, and I think in our daily lives today, there's still lots of self-deception, and I think that as an individual, and about myself, and I think that about Search as an organization and our field, exactly as Andy was saying, you know, human beings are wired that way. Either we're overly critical of ourselves and each other, or the opposite, we're overly laudatory of ourselves or of each other, right? And this field is filled with beautiful people who are motivated by really wonderful things, peace, bringing about nonviolence and really being a force more powerful, like Peter Ackerman says. And sometimes we're delusional, you know, really, how can a tiny NGO in a place like the Democratic Republic of Congo, in light of how many actors and the stakes being so high and the traffic of arms and of people and of drugs and the socio-political realities being that and diamond mining. I mean, how can you really? So I think there was some self-deception, but I think, frankly, there was also some minimizing of the positive effects that our field in general actually has. And we don't know sufficiently well how to speak to our results as a conglomerate of organizations. And that's why it's really wonderful that the attention of USIP, the Alliance for Peacebuilding, the European Peacebuilding Liaison Office, and all of the related organizations are actually coming together in a much more effective way than in the last 20 years to really analyze what's self-deception, what's reality, who are the actors with whom we must engage in order to effect real change? Because the main self-deception I feel we all had, not just Search for Common Ground, was that we were very tempted to always just, what's the expression, preach to the converted, and to just speak to people who are like-minded. Well, guess what? It's not like-minded people who are ultimately really committing the acts of violence or the injustices that lead to the need for peace building. So reaching out and really questioning ourselves about our motivations, our approach, the whole do no harm, of course, is just one facet of that work. But, yeah.
I wonder if I could follow up on one thing you said in terms of the type of individuals that enter our field, and maybe even sort of how Search as an organization, when they're hiring, how do you balance wanting to find that passion with also wanting to find that sort of analytic nature in people that are willing to be self-reflective? Because there, I think there is a tension sometimes, you know, between those two characteristics of people.
There absolutely is. And few and far between are the people who actually have both things simultaneously. We happen to have a couple of people on staff, our vice president of programs, Lena Slackmulder, or in fact, the person who leads our institutional learning team and our design and monitoring and evaluation work, Vanessa Corlazzoli, who happen to have both. They can analyze, reflect, and they can also act. But what you're saying, Andy, is very accurate at Search for Common Ground. Our modus operandi is very much about action oriented. And sometimes we haven't taken the time to step back and think. So what happened in 2004 is that we decided to put together a team that was very small at the time, but is no longer quite so small, in order for them to be the specialists about that process of thinking and looking at what monitoring about, you know, what activities are we doing, but then trying to define what results we're having against the objectives and goals that we've set out for ourselves, and help us to determine what the benchmarks are and do things like baselines and surveys and evaluations and all of those things. But it took quite a number of years, and God knows it's a work in progress, but it took quite a number of years before we realized that you can't have things in isolation. If you have design monitoring and evaluation specialists who aren't working as an integral part of a team on the country programs, and or if your country director or your program managers or your finance staff, for that matter, aren't also thinking in terms of what is it that you must from the get-go put into your thinking and into your programming in order to be able to reap the information and the data that you need in order to understand how you're doing, then you're really working in an inefficient manner. It's something, the word mainstream is overused, but of course that's what I'm talking about. All of us thinking differently about monitoring and evaluation.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm joined in the studio today by my co-host, Andy Blum. He's the Vice President of Program Management and Evaluation here at the United States Institute of Peace. He's also the lead instructor in the online Global Campus course, Demystifying Monitoring and Evaluation for Practitioners. And our guest is Sandra Malone. She's the Executive Vice President of Search for Common Ground, one of the world's leading international non-governmental organizations working in peacebuilding and conflict transformation. I also want to invite any of our listeners tuning in online to chime in with your own questions or comments for Sandra or for Andy, and just share your own perspectives on monitoring and evaluation and the various issues that have come up in our discussion today. And actually, I wanted to bring up, there's a student in our course. There are many students in this course that are coming to this experience with their own specific monitoring and evaluation challenges. And we wanted to raise one here. Andy, did you want to share with us what that specific challenge is?
Sure. And I think it goes to what Sandra was saying actually just now in terms of mainstreaming. And it's a very sort of common challenge as organizations are trying to improve their monitoring and evaluation. They want to bring in outside expertise to help with that. You know, but one of our students has talked about the fact they brought in an external M&E specialist to help develop a monitoring and evaluation framework for a citizen engagement program, but it was not a positive experience. There were aspects of the program that the outside expert didn't understand. There's a lot of times cultural issues when you bring somebody from the outside into an organization. So I wonder, Sandra, if you could talk to sort of lessons that Search has learned about how best to use outside experts, whether that's evaluators or consultants, to help with your monitoring and evaluation processes.
Sure. Thank you. I feel your pain, dear student. We've been there, done that. Lots of learning that comes from both the external and the internal evaluation processes, right? They differ very much one from the other. So in terms of the accountability, the deep commitment that we feel and the integrity we know we must have to accountability, there are two dimensions to it, I would say, primarily. One is to the external world that isn't directly affected. I mean, we're all interconnected. So, of course, we're all affected when something terrible happens to a human being. It happens to all of us and vice versa, less so, unfortunately. But one of the keys is to really spend the time, if it's doable, deciding with the external evaluators what approach is going to be taken, and to really have, whether it's your donor requesting it or a partner, to really be able to talk in depth about how and why you've come about wanting to do something and why you've done it a certain way. And if you haven't done your own reflection beforehand, then it's a really tough premise. And of course, people can, whether they're external or internal to the organization, can really disagree fundamentally with your approach, your methodology, your practice, who you are as a human being. I mean, we know that, you know, interpersonal relations enter a lot. If we have, you know, a not so pleasant or not so polished staff who engages, I don't know, not so politely, or just they just don't get along, then that affects how the evaluation comes out too. But let me just say a couple things just briefly about how we try to both balance that external and internal use and maximize the learning both for whoever's asking us the questions and for Search for Common Ground to develop over time. So the first thing is that we really try to have the processes as inclusive as possible. And so very early on, we engage with our donors, we engage with our partners, we engage with, you know, friends of friends, the government, depends, you know, who the powers are. And we try to make it as inclusive as possible, which is not something that is habitual, or at least historically has been habitual to people, even in peace building. And it seems counterintuitive not to. But anyway, we're very inclusive in the development of our proposals, so that when you're trying to evaluate what's going on, you've actually agreed upstream about what is supposed to be going on. And so you have a basis from which to jump together to evaluate. Secondly, not only is there the opportunity for discussing the baseline information, reflecting with our partners, reflecting on the monitoring data, co-creating the evaluations and reflecting on their evaluation findings. But one of the things we do a lot is have reflection meetings. And they're really part and parcel of how we do our work. And those are incredible because, you know, they go from sharing of the budget. I mean, believe it or not, many of our colleagues in the field work in partnership, but the partnership is, it's not somehow equal. So it's more like we are giving you something and you do it to serve our purposes. Whereas here, I'm not saying we do it perfectly, far from it, but our philosophy is to do it from the get-go together. And then we are also trying to make sure that the learning in country is shared not only within that country program, but across the programs between countries. And we have a number of relatively new fora which are open to whoever would like to attend. So, for example, we have a series which is called What Works. And the latest one, it's a monthly series. The latest one was on countering violent extremism. Well, we're all at a loss. What works? And how do we pool our resources to understand how to make a difference in that space?
How can our listeners tap into that series?
Oh, we can just send around through you the website links. They're two very precious, if you're talking about peace building and monitoring and evaluation, there are two sites that are really important to us. One of them is, and we work, of course, with USIP and Alliance for Peace Building and all kinds of other organizations, the DM&E for Peace Portal. It used to be called the Peace Portal. And that now has 5,000 registered users. And people just post their materials, ask questions, and really engage in that whole evaluation and monitoring process online. But also there are specific things through our website that you can access at www.sfcg.org.
You know, one of the things is, as I'm hearing Sandra talk about these meetings and about the consultations, it's sort of a hard lesson we had to learn here, that bringing in an outside person actually probably demands more work inside the organization than not. You never sort of save time by turning something over to an outside consultant or evaluator. In fact, it's often the opposite.
So, I mean, these are just some of the challenges. I mean, we're tapping into a lot here, this challenge of self-deception, the balance struck between internal and external evaluation. So I wanted you to take us back to 2003, 2004, when Search made this intentional, conscious decision, we need to do monitoring and evaluation better. And if you can remember, what was it like in the office, in the organization at that time? What level of the staff drove these changes at Search? Was it a top-down, kind of call, or a bottom-up initiative, or was it both?
Or neither.
Or perhaps neither.
I think it's probably neither. So I don't think that it was our top leadership who really focused us in on looking at learning this way. Doing better, more Absolutely. But in the sense of really getting structures, systems, processes in place to gather something that in many ways is quite analytical and can be quite abstract until you know how to use it and apply it, right? Mm. That wasn't from our executive team, nor was it from, I would say, very junior staff. It was really, as I reflect upon it, more, let's call it middle management, and people who were looking both from directly in Search for Common Ground, but also who were commenting about us from the external world, who were like, you know, it might be good to start looking at that nexus between the really action-oriented, field-based, as we're called, work that Search for Common Ground does, and some of the more rigorous, exciting, innovative, more research-oriented, academic-oriented work that is being done or that could be done. And is there stuff, are there methodologies out there from the development world or from humanitarian aid or other spheres that might apply to Search for Common Ground? So it was actually a schlep. That's a word to, for those who don't understand, that means it wasn't an easy process to get us as the full leadership of Search for Common Ground on board with, this is not an option that's imposed from outside when DFID or USAID tells you you must do a framework, and you look at that framework with fear. You're like, how do I answer these questions, etc.? I want to just be doing the mediation. That it's an absolute moral imperative to really take the time to design programs where you can analyze the effects that you're having. So we went from there to having a very solid team in the regions in which we work, but it took time. And, you know, it's scary to some people. And not all the same people have to do all the same things. So you must, as part of the beauty of the professionalization, is that an English word, professionalization, of our peace-building fields, so do you need experts. And in a peace-building organization, you need experts in mediation, you need experts in radio programming, you need experts in knowledge management, and putting those pieces together over time. Yeah.
You talked about it being a moral imperative, and you know there's an ethical principle that ought implies can. So you have to give people the capacity to fulfill this moral imperative. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, in those early days or what you're doing now, you know, what are the most effective strategies you found to build capacity to do monitoring and evaluation throughout your organization?
So, of course, over the last 10 years in particular, we have been trying different things. And part of that has been that different staff have different approaches to it within Search for Common Ground, but also because the body of knowledge about what works and doesn't work has also grown tremendously around the world. And so we're trying to adapt to those things. One of the things we've come up with very recently, and it's going to be hot off the proverbial press this month, in fact, is called conflict scans. And what we've been able to develop is a 10-question questionnaire, which our programs, and anybody else, of course, can use in order to really do in real time analysis about what is happening or no longer happening in terms of the conflict dynamics. Because we all know what the problem is when you start, let's take a European Union grant, okay? You are in September 2012, and you put in all of the frameworks and information about how you're going to do the M&E, etc. and the situation in Yemen or Pakistan or Central African Republic. I mean, in parentheses, all you need to do is say those words to really understand how it is that your programming and your monitoring and evaluation not only have to have a solid vision, but man, do they need to be adaptable, because the dynamics in those places change so rapidly, and the gathering of the information can really take a very big shift. So you need to be adaptable. So anyway, we've developed a conflict scan, and it's 10 questions to really understand what has shifted in the environment and therefore what it is that you should look for and adapt to make sure that your programming still matters, that you're doing the right things. Because that proposal from September 2014, the reality today is really different. Yet, the tools which you have promised you would be using are still likely on paper old ones. So one little tip I'd like to add here is that the in real time communication with partners and with the donor community or the governments with whom you work is supra important. Because anybody who knows about Yemen or Pakistan or Central African Republic will also know that you can't be static.
So that seems very difficult because, as you mentioned, things are always changing and shifting, particularly in conflict-affected communities. So it'd be wonderful to hear a little bit more about the process. And I'm reminded of something that you talked about this week in the course, Andy, something called feedback loops. My first question is, are these conflict scans, would you consider that a feedback loop? And what are some other examples of feedback loops that help folks who are doing these programs and working on these projects and are part of the community to constantly be evaluating what's working, what's not working, and then how do we change the program? Who makes that decision? You know, it sounds like it involves so many people, a lot of meetings, but things are happening minute by minute, hour by hour. So what does that process look like?
So there is a lot of convening, a lot of talking, a lot of reevaluating, but you want to get to the action above and beyond that, right? Otherwise, you can drown in your own feedback loop.
Paralysis
by analysis. And indeed, the conflict scans are a feedback loop, a feedback mechanism, but they're one of them. We also actually physically bring together, both on a regional basis and a cross-regional basis, our specialists in DM&E with our partners often, sometimes just internally. But something I was saying earlier on in our conversation that's really important for us, and it took us a while to realize, and that is that fundamentally the conversations, the organic and or forced conversations that need to happen, have to happen with the folk who are not the monitoring and evaluation specialists. And bringing the information from outside that particular conflict zone into the conversations with our partners, you know, how do we prove this? How do we monitor that, et cetera, on an ongoing basis is absolutely vital. So we have actually now, and this is just as of, I guess, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, maybe, really decentralized our M&E capacity. So we have four regions, two in Africa, Middle East and North Africa, and Asia. And while Vanessa directs from headquarters the work of four regional design monitoring and evaluation specialists, in each of the countries we have, I guess it's 34 or 35 specialists. And they're really engaging all the time with our teams in this loop, in this loop, and hopefully making some breakthroughs. It's like anything else, examples from outside and posing questions in a non-threatening and in a very supportive way is really something that that Lena and Vanessa, our colleagues who lead up this work, have made us really live. And we're not perfect at it, but it is a question. We question ourselves now, and we make sure that as much as possible, resources are decentralized out from a kind of theoretical, either, you know, the ether or books, into what does that mean pragmatically for our colleagues on the ground.
I assume there are several people who want to be part of this constant evaluation process, or they want the information on how your programs have been evaluated, your staff, your board, beneficiaries, or the communities in which you seek to serve, and your donors. They all want that information, but they all want it for different reasons. They're looking for different things. So how does SEARCH balance the tension between evaluation as a tool for accountability to donors, to the communities that you're serving, with evaluation as a tool for learning amongst your staff and others?
So, as you say, I mean, it is a balance, and it relates to something I was saying earlier, which is you try to really negotiate with the external world what it is that they need for what reasons. And then you try to analyze internally, okay, well, in this world where there is so much data being thrown into your face and so many numbers and so many facts and figures, what at the end of the day matters? And of course, there are some constituencies to whom we have to render accounts, where we may frankly think, my God, that is useless information, who cares? And you still have to do it. But you want to try to tip the balance so that the information you're gathering for the external world, board, donors, well, board is actually still your world, but nonetheless, actually aids you. And what I find really great about the last decade in particular is that there is a willingness and a capacity for actors like the U.S. Institute of Peace, like SEARCH for Common Ground, like many of our colleagues, to actually engage with the donor community to kind of challenge and push the envelope and say, okay, really get that we need to be accountable, but can we reflect together about what we're trying to achieve? And I don't want to be naive. People's motivations for getting some information may be very different from you, and they have their own needs. So you have to honor those as well. But don't forget that we're all really learning how to build this field of monitoring and evaluation for peace building with our donors, with our boards, with our organizations, with our partners. And so it behooves all of us to be in a cooperative questioning mode together.
You know, I wonder what you see, or maybe what Vanessa even sees as SEARCH's sort of biggest challenges right now. You know, what are the things within your organization that are making Vanessa, who's leading up your learning and evaluation efforts, what's making her sort of pull her hair out today? What are the biggest challenges that you think you face now, sort of starting from where you are now in your organization?
I'm laughing because Vanessa has the most beautiful head of hair you've ever seen. She's got very long, flowing black hair, and she doesn't seem to be losing any of it, nor does she seem to be going gray, which I am. But nonetheless, she does pull her hair out very regularly.
Metaphorically.
Yes, metaphorically. One of the reasons is that very often we rush to put in a budget and put in a proposal. which hasn't been sufficiently thought out, meaning not that the activities are bad or the motivations for them, but how are you going to do? Have you done a baseline? Do you have the money to do the baseline? And if you speak to 36 people, does that really matter? Should we not see how we could get a larger sampling of people to whom to speak? So the attention to the details upstream, then the pushback that we get both from the donors and from our teams, the push and pull of where the resources, the time, the people, the money, the technology, let's not forget the importance of technology to do the reaping of a lot of the data, et cetera, that there are so many competing interests that often something like monitoring and evaluation can actually get scratched from the actual proposal. So if you are an organization like Search for Common Ground that doesn't have core funding that's project driven, then all of a sudden you've got a project, but you ain't got no monitoring and evaluation, and that's a big problem. Okay. What we see happening is actually more and more interest in funding monitoring and evaluation, which is fabulous. So it's less of a problem than it used to be. But, you know, training of our staff. Look, if you ask me to do monitoring and evaluation of a specific project at Search for Common Ground, I would need some serious training at USIP and some serious training from Vanessa and Lena. I could get it, but a lot of our staff in all of the countries in which we work, we don't choose them because they're experts in monitoring and evaluation. We choose them because we know that with time, with training, they would blossom into being really great monitoring and evaluation specialists if we can't find them in some of the conflict zones where we work. And mix, anyway, so there are a lot of complexities, and I'll just say, you know, the names of a couple countries again, so that we can really internalize how immensely difficult it is to do M&E work in a place like Yemen today, mm-hmm. like Pakistan today, like Central African Republic today, like South Sudan today. And so, yeah, you want to tear your hair out, but then you see the incredible richness that comes from a well-designed, well-monitored, well-evaluated project, and you just, you know, regain all of your hair and you realize that there are many things that you never thought that Search for Common Ground could actually achieve, which you hadn't even set out to achieve, that you have achieved. And you wouldn't know that if you don't monitor and pay attention. So,
Sandra, thank you so much for being with us today. Our guest has been Sandra Malone, Executive Vice President of Search for Common Ground. And again, thanks for taking the time today to be with us.
What a pleasure to meet all of you. Thank you for the work that your team does, Andy, and for the course that you've put together. It's a wonderful thing. Great.
My co-host today has been Andy Blum, Vice President for Program Management and Evaluation here at USIP. He's also the lead instructor in the Global Campus online course, Demystifying Monitoring and Evaluation for Peacebuilding Initiatives. Andy, thank you for being with us today in the studio.
It was a pleasure. And just adding my thanks for Sandra taking the time to be here.
You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our producers are Leah Cullens, Vanessa Francis, Kara Stevens, Althea Middleton-Detzner, and Peter Weinberger. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Blake Mobley. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday at 2:30 p.m. Our guest will be Bijan Nashat, Director of Programs and Advocacy at Save the Children Germany. Until then, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.